Welcome to the We Raise the Stars and Stripes Over Japan podcast. This is Mark Steven Schwartz, and it is both an honor and a privilege for me to read the diaries of American and Allied civilian prisoners of war interned in and around Kobe, Japan during the Great Pacific War, World War II. This is episode number 8. Starting January 6th, 1942.
With the first diary entry from Charles F. Gregg. Breakfast at 9:30, and then news to pack. Inspection first, then prepare for leaving. One small bundle or hand luggage per person, and those who had trunks or to leave them for separate transportation. The interpreter said there had been too much talk and that today or tomorrow we were leaving for Sumé. But after Sumé, the embarkation point, where then? Tokyo or Honolulu? We will probably not know until we are underway or arrive at the ultimate destination. And that could be any of 100 different places. At any rate, in a few hours, or at most days, we will be going somewhere. A bit of humor this morning when Larry Neese, one of the contractor's men, came in to surrender after hiding in the boondocks for a month. He's a little deaf and walked through Agana unmolested. On arriving at the cathedral, he approached with his hands up to surrender, but wasn't allowed in. They motioned him to go on away. He finally went around the building and had to sneak inside before they would accept his surrender. Several men came in this evening, but with no news. Their surrender was uneventful, although Scuttlebutt has it they have been questioned. All radios on the island have been confiscated. Time drags on with the possibility of leaving any moment. Harold Brinkerhoff. The usual small breakfast. Only an appetizer. We are all ready for the main course. Excitement has been running high for several days. We all dread the thought of going to Japan as it is very cold this time of year, we are told by those who have been there. The last missing contractor turned in today. There are still 15 men missing or unaccounted for. I am just as well pleased I did not stay out. The fellows say the mosquitoes almost ate them up. They were continually on the move to keep from being caught. There were troops of cavalry scouring the country every day. I shouldn't have minded staying out a couple of weeks, but we had expected succor by our countrymen before this. I guess we have been forgotten, or the U.S. has its hands full. Dean Brunton. Although I had thought when I surrendered that I had been among the last to do so, I found there were 15 or 20 Americans as yet unaccounted for, including the casualties. Some of the missing men turned up on the second day of my imprisonment, and from then on they came in every day, in groups of three or four for about a week. The tales they told made me glad that I had chosen to come in when I did. The Japs were beating the bushes with bloodhounds and flamethrowers, and were dealing harshly with those they found hiding out. One evening, they brought in an old resident of Sumé, Otto Cox. Upon his arrival at the prison, Mr. Cox was severely beaten and thrown into solitary confinement. A Jap soldier who spoke little English told us he would be executed in the morning. The following day, long before sunrise, we were all suddenly called to report immediately in the courtyard outside the prison room. We were hastily pushed into three columns and were confronted by a large number of Jap riflemen and two machine guns. The situation looked grim, and we wondered what the next few minutes would bring. There was a Jap battle flag on what could be seen in the dim light, numerous inscriptions in Japanese. Very softly, someone near me whispered, "Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light?" A very officious Jap army officer arrived and was greeted by salutes and the bowing that is always accorded superiors in Japanese respect. He barked an order, and the riflemen placed the rifles in a position which could have easily been the first motion of an execution order. Perhaps it was just nerves, but I learned later that I was not the only one who thought it was all up with us for right then. We were given about 15 minutes of calisthenics, Japanese fashion, after which we were rushed back to our prison room with the same dispatch that had marked our sudden order out a few minutes previously. We were not permitted to lie down again, but remained standing until daylight when the windows of the room, few enough in number, were all ordered closed, and we again wondered what was about to happen. We were given about 15 minutes of calisthenics, Japanese fashion, after which we were rushed back to our prison room with the same dispatch that had marked our sudden order out a few minutes previously. We were not permitted to lie down again, but remained standing until daylight, when the windows of the room, few enough in number, were all ordered closed, and we again wondered what was about to happen. We were marched outside again, this time into the street, to a schoolhouse a few yards away, which proved to be our prison quarters for another week. Immediately after our arrival there, we heard a terrific sound like a blast and the grapevine, which spread news rapidly, reported that Otto Cox had just been executed by a firing squad outside the walls of the building we had just vacated. Luckily, the grapevine was in error, for friend Cox was delivered to his new quarters with us about an hour later. We all felt much better. My wife was not imprisoned and was permitted to visit me twice each day. Although food was difficult to obtain, she brought me enough to help tremendously, as the daily ration of food allowed us by the Japanese was pitifully small. We usually had half a boiled potato in the morning, another half in the afternoon, and that was all. Sometimes it would be a small slice of bread, but in any case, the supply was far from sufficient to meet the most simple requirements of nutrition, and most of the men lost about a pound each day. Guamanian friends often came to the assistance of the imprisoned men, and it is certain that many bowls of dry steamed rice, the meat, and the fruit that they sent or brought in to the hapless men was a great help in those hours of need, and will always be remembered and appreciated. It required a great deal of courage to come to the door of the prison and ask permission to deliver a gift to an inmate. The Jap guards resented any display of friendship of this nature and frequently slapped the gift bearer until, with a bleeding nose and aching head, the benevolent one went away and returned no more, leaving his figs upon the ground where it had fallen. It was just the sort of treatment that turned the Guamanians so wholeheartedly against the sons of heaven and made them our steadfast supporters when we came back to retake our island 2.5 years later. Their loyalty to us was an inspiration then, and history has recorded the many brave deeds they have performed since. January 7th, 1942. Charles F. Gregg. Well, the night passed uneventfully, except for a stray cat that got in the room and defied ejection, letting out cries and meows frequently. Another day of wonder waiting and watching for development. Most men are ready for instantaneous departure. The majority believe for some Japanese possession. 9:30 p.m. and we are still here. Rumor. Wild rumor continues. All concur we are going someplace, but where? I may be an optimistic fool, but I believe we will be sent back to the States, at least the civilians. More and more were brought in today, including those formerly allowed freedom of the town, George Shop, etc. All civilians were mustered today and names called for a master roll. Persons other than American citizens by birth were segregated and passed before high Japanese Army and Navy officers for disposition. The only ones told to their destinations were the bishop and lay brother, Spanish, who were told they would be sent to another island under Japanese military rule. The rest? No one knows. Large dinner tonight, mainly rice with a partial scoop of stew. Most food rations we have had, and we surely needed it. Walking, exercise, chess, showers, reading, and mainly talking occupied the day. Did play billiards with Mr. Hubbard, and under his good coaching beat him 31-30. Lots of rain all the day before yesterday, that night, and most yesterday. It is just starting in again. Major Spicer provided himself 100% again this evening when he thought I was shorted at chow and picked up additional rice from me. Reason? Someone accidentally broke my plate today. With this rain, it's a good night for sleep, so here goes. Dick Arvidson. We learned that two Guamanian natives were shot for either looting or attempting to pass prescribed information to prisoners inside the camp. Harold Brinkerhoff. People are still bringing in blankets and heavy clothing. We do not know whether it is that we are not where we are going or just to allay our suspicions. The majority still thinks we're going. I saw Chong outside with a bundle of clothes. They were for me, but the guards wouldn't let her leave them. She stayed around for some time. Later in the day, the guards let some things in, but alas, Chong had departed. A boy who brings Notley's food brought my old work shoes the other day. I had asked him to bring me some shoes, but didn't specify which. Maybe my good shoes have been taken by the Japs. I'm glad to get the old ones, as I've been wearing tennis shoes all this time, and they are not conducive to sweet-smelling feet. Charles F. Gregg. Another day of readiness to move, but no gestures towards their departure were made. Quite a detachment of Japanese sailors came up and looked us over like we were so many animals in the zoo. The sailors are supposed to take us over the military guard of prisoners before long. The day was notable because of the lack of scuttlebutt or guesses as to what was going to be done with us and how the war was progressing. Thomas picked up an arm rash and I've developed a sore throat. Otherwise, all are well. Harold Brinkerhoff. Chong has not been back. I guess she was frightened by the way she was treated yesterday. She's very timid and backward. Some of the native women are not, or at least appear not to be afraid in the least. The Japs are putting the natives in their place. There's a station at the bottom of the hill coming to Aganya. The natives have to stop there and bow to the guards. There's a sign that reads, "You must stop and bow to us." We only have to bow when we wish to go to the toilet or wish some courtesy. Some of the guards are quite snotty about it. In the bullpen, I went to the door and pointed that I wanted to go to the head. The guard acted as though he didn't even see me. A fellow standing by said, "Bow." I did and was immediately recognized. It is supposed to be a courtesy. Guards on being relieved bow to one another. Officers bow to each other also. There's something in the air. There have been loaded trucks moving all night heading towards Petey. Trucks with food stores and rolling kitchens have been going by. Several wishful thinkers say they are evacuating as our forces are coming and troops have been marching by with full packs. It is possible our troops have finally gotten around to striking back. At every sound of a plane, we dash out. No success. They all have the rising sun insignia. Bryant Sterling. On January 8th, we were told to pack up preparatory to leaving. Great excitement among the men. Next announcement was for us not to pack our bedding as we might not leave that night, but anytime this week. Dick Arvidsson. What we came to call bamboo wives were heard to be expressing goodbyes to their companions in the prison. Through this, we became aware that we would probably be leaving Guam in the very near future. January 9th, 1942. Charles F. Gregg. The day passed quietly until 3 p.m. when the governor, Commander Giles, Doctors Van Pennen, Moe, and Captain Lineberry, and all the sick patients able to travel were moved out of the hospital to the church. There was a regular get-together and much talk of where we were going and when we would leave. Things really looked ominous, so after dinner, all the provisions and canned goods were opened, and the last supper was had in Guam. January 10th, 1942, with a diary entry from Max Brodowski. After 30 days of merciless treatment, scant rations, and confinement, we were loaded on the Argentina Maru, one of the NYK luxury liners. Our quarters were in the steerage, in a space placarded for 180 coolies. We became acquainted with stinkfish, which was to become one of the sources of subsistence for the next 4 years. Charles F. Gregg. Last supper was right. Reveille at 4:30 a.m., packed and had a hurried breakfast, then mustered on the plaza and names checked off a master list by the Japanese. At 6:30, all were accounted for. The men were marched to the Petey Navy Yard, and the sick, infirm, and aged loaded into boats and taken out to the Petey Channel in Motor Sailor Number 1. Others had been bombed or wrecked. There were a large number of small Japanese motor launches ferrying supplies out to ships in the harbor. There were 12 steamers, freighter type, in the harbor and one large passenger liner. Two of the freighters had guns mounted on fore and aft gun decks. The rest appeared unarmed. We were placed aboard the passenger boat, which was of quite modern design. We later found out it was the Argentina Maru, 16,000 tons, age about 3 years. Aboard were all the American prisoners and the few other nationals of Canada, Spain, etc. The priests were also taken with us. After the muster, we were lined up by groups and put into our quarters. Steerage in the hold, and Oriental steerage at that. 400 of us were packed into the two aft holds like so many sardines. 16 of us, six from Pan Am, were packed into a little room off the hold. The room was constructed for a max of 10 people. We were given a blanket and boards to sleep on, 8 in the lower bunking space and 8 in the top tier. By sleeping head to toes, the 8 of us would just fit, but you touch the person next to you. Area 6 by 12 feet. Well, a new experience. Air is foul. Washing and toilet facilities are disgustingly inadequate. and bathing facilities are non-existent. The food, though inadequate, is larger in quantity than at Guam, however. Lots of rice with a sauce of ground green beans and a soybean chicory coffee. The first night's sleep was a little ragged, but people can get used to anything, they say. The ship lifted anchor at approximately 2 p.m. and appeared to move off in a north-northwest direction. Several people believe that the boat would take us to Hull Island, said it was too good a boat merely to take us to Japan. Doctors told to take 7-day medical supplies. Dean Brunton. We were called to muster outside the Catholic Church. There were Jap Army trucks into which we were loaded the few possessions that remained to us, small bundles of clothing and toilet articles which we had been allowed to retain. Some had no bundles, their only worldly possessions being the light tropical clothing they wore. Some of the prisoners were allowed to ride the trucks, and the remainder were marched along the road bordering the sea from Maganya to Petey, the airport about 4 miles away. The governor of the island and most of the administrative officials were compelled to walk, probably an attempt on the part of the Jap Army to humiliate them before the population. If this were so, the design failed completely. For all along the road, the pitiful procession was greeted by the tearful faces of the Guamanians, who displayed the most profound sympathy and respect. Meanwhile, the unwilling marchers held their heads proudly erect and exhibited such spirit as must have embarrassed their captors. From the very beginning of the adventure, the courageous and spirited attitude of the prisoners was incomprehensible to the Japs. If they expected to find us beaten and dejected, they were destined to be disappointed. I never heard of any instance in which a single man ever lost confidence in our ultimate and total victory. We knew what the outcome would be, but we could not predict the duration of the war and could not now know how long our unpleasant life as prisoners might be expected to last. Roy Henning. Boarded the Argentina Maru, eat rice. 22 knots, some pitching, issued heavy clothing, interesting passage, not luxury. Down in the hold, well below the waterline, unescorted, with a ship doing some zigging and zagging. Bud Durham. The food aboard ship was terrible. We had to eat rotten fish and rice full of maggots. You had to close your eyes to eat the rice because of the maggots. Every time they were counted, the Japanese would come up with a different number. Harold Brinkerhoff. We were awakened at 4:30 a.m. and told we had 30 minutes to pack to go to Japan. We had a boiled potato, piece of bologna, and coffee. At 6 a.m., some of us were loaded in trucks for Petey. Most walked. As we rounded the plaza, many natives lined the street. All were crying as we passed by. I felt very sad for those whose fathers were leaving with us, as none could foretell whether we would reach Japan or ever return. We arrived in Petey. We were checked and rechecked. We sat, we stood, and were made to stand again, then sit. Wait, 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 how I wish we would do something. Finally, late in the afternoon, we were put in ship-to-shore boats and headed for the harbor's mouth. We are making for a large liner. There are 14 small transports standing by. We were taken to the liner. It is the Argentina Maru. We sailed about 6 p.m., a long, long day. The Maru is really making knots, about 22 of them. By dark, we had covered a lot of water. We were put in the steerage compartment up in the stern. There are platform-type bunks, upper and lower, 9 men to a level. I'm up. We were issued one blanket. It is stifling hot. They just started air circulating. We were served 2 small fried fish and a large plate of rice. the largest quantity of food we had had in a long time. It is 8 p.m., and we had not eaten since 5 a.m. I was ravenously hungry. Dean Brunton. We left Guam about 4 in the afternoon on board the motor ship Argentina Maru. Our quarters were the steerage space abaft the engine room. There was very little ventilation, and our beds consisted of boards and a makeshift bunk arrangement that was thoroughly crowded and entirely lacking in comfort. We were kept in our compartment by guards with fixed bayonets. Our food consisted of boiled rice, so full of dead worms that it surpassed anything of which I had ever heard, although I have read many a story of the wormy food sailors were reported to have eaten in the old whaling ship days. There was also an occasional mackerel which had apparently been kept in a brine of salt, seawater, and blood. Many who ate it became violently ill. Reed Hubbard. Ousted at 4 a.m., marched her hull to Petey and placed on MS Argentina Maru for a transfer to Japan. A first-class ship, almost empty, but they put almost 500 of us, including officers and the governor of Guam, in a hold not large enough for 100. Hot, poorly ventilated, no room even to lie in bed to eat. Rice and rotten fish served twice a day, an unpalatable mess. Many sick. Five women nurses and Mrs. Helmers and infant daughter placed in separate quarters, not much better. Allowed few minutes deck exercise each day. No water for baths or washing and very small quantity of very poor drinking water. Bryant Sterling. On January 10th at 4:30 a.m., we get the Reveille call with the news we're about to be ready for the road by 5:30 a.m. Our gang eats first that morning and we get seconds. Fairly good breakfast, horse cock, which is bologna, and spuds, bologna and potatoes. We assemble in plaza, half a gang goes in trucks, while myself and the gang in the church school walk to Petey about 6 miles. Leave at 6:30 a.m. to make Petey at 8:30 a.m. The odd part of the whole deal was that they made the governor walk. He led our group of about 150 or so men, at least his stomach did, McMillan. Also, Eldridge and Hubbard had to walk. Waited around 2 hours at Petey, then took lighter to Japanese liner in Sume Bay. This boat we boarded was the Argentina Maru, Japanese luxury liner about the size of President Taft. Hadn't been in troop service long as she still had her luxurious accommodations, although they were covered up with sheets. We mustered on the promenade deck and there found the rest of our gang who had traveled by truck. Next, we were taken down below to the third-class passenger quarters. Got an upper bunk on the outside, metal bunks, upper and lower. Boards were laid on top of bunks and each bunk accommodated 8 men. Alton White was my bedmate. Also, Matt Corley, Pleitner, Joel Morgenthalen, Fraser, and Clutus. We were given 1 blanket each. We leave Guam about 2 p.m. January 10th, 1942. Japanese gathered up huge pile of contractors' clothes, also those belonging to the Marines and sailors, and sent these aboard the ship. While in the process of being divided up, I jump in and grab 1 Marine's coat, 1 sailor's coat, 1 new sailor's pants, 1 Marine's pants, 3 watch hats, 1 overseas hat, armful of shirts, and 2 sailor's jumpers. Gave 1 watch hat to Bill, 1 to Art, Gary Lane later grabs it off his head, and kept 1 for myself. The Marine pants and coat and sailor jumpers were invaluable later on. We were also issued shorts, undershirt, ties, and socks, and towel. One thing lacking were overcoats, and as the days passed, we could see we would need them. Many of the men got their own clothes back.
And this concludes Episode 8 of the We Raise the Stars and Stripes Over Japan podcast. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye now.